talk is on Vedic Godheads, symbols of profound psycho-spiritual truths. But we can look at it in the larger picture because Vedic Godheads are not disconnected from the rest of the Vedas. There has been much talk about Sanatana Dharma of late and its revival. But to truly revive Sanatana Dharma, as Sri Aurobindo says, we have to discover it within us. It has to be lived. And if they are not lived and merely spoken of and heard, then perhaps we may preserve a great sacred and holy tradition, but we'll not be doing the fullest justice to the heritage that we speak about. So what really is Sanatana Dharma? There are three aspects of Sanatana Dharma which very beautifully Sri Aurobindo brings out. One, Sanatan or the eternal. There is an eternal basis or reality behind all existence. This is the very first thing, the bedrock of all things. Existence is not just a phenomena floating in empty space, but there is something eternal, something that lasts, something that is permanent, that outlasts the changes of time. And behind all appearances, there is a truth, a reality, which has been called by different names. But this reality, to discover it, to realize it, to live it, to find it, this is the first bedrock of Sanatana Dharma, that there is an eternal reality behind this changing, phenomenal, transient world. But along with that, there comes another aspect of Sanatana Dharma. What is, if there is such a reality, what is the way to arrive at it? What is the dharma we must follow? What is that which we must hold on to? If we take the root dharma from the root dhra, to hold. So in the first definition, there is an eternal reality which holds this world. The second, what is that we must hold on to arrive at that eternal reality? So there is second aspect of the Sanatana Dharma. What is the path to reach that one who is, or what that is behind all this world? So this is the second aspect which immediately takes us into the realm of yoga. And Veda not just as sacred text, of course they are sacred, but Vedas as textbooks of an inner yoga, an inner path, which we all can undertake to arrive at that one reality, which is what would be the main focus today as to what is that inner path of the Vedas, which we all can undertake. The third thing about Sanatana Dharma is, well, this eternal reality is not disconnected from the rest of the world. Very often when we speak about this eternal reality, we make it appear as if that alone is true and all this is unreal. It's like cutting away the problem, not even acknowledging it, that there is something which is here, which I experience in my cognition, in my feelings, in my will. So what is the relation between that reality and this? In other words, if my dealings with life should be based on as close a resemblance as to the way that relates with this world. If that is cut off from this world, then the logical thing is I should myself cut off from this world. Then there can be no talk of Sanatana Dharma, there can be no talk of, in fact, anything at all. We need to simply cut off from this world and enter or retire into a monastery. But if you look at the life of the Vedic period, the sages were not cut off from life. Many of them were deeply engaged with life. They were warriors. They in fact, people had to go to the sages to learn the art of war, to learn the science, to learn the technology, administration, polity. So there, this truth has a relationship with this world of phenomenal appearances, and we suffer because we have a wrong kind of orientation. So adharma is essentially, in with regard to, yes, please come. So adharma is when we deviate from the kind of relationship that truth has with this phenomenal world. And dharma, the third definition of dharma in terms of Sanatana Dharma is, we should relate with this world the way the eternal relates with this world. And there are plenty of passages which, you know, subsequently in the Upanishads, when the very first sloka of each Upanishad says, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yat Kincha Jagatyam Jagat Tena Tyaktena Bhunjitha Magridha Kasya Suddhanam. It's a very solid way of relating with this world. We don't run away from objects of the world. We don't run away from situation, events, but we relate with it as the divine relates with this, as Isha relates with it. In other words, Sanatana Dharma involves three levels. One, the deepest level, the core of existence. There is an eternal reality, and this phenomenal world doesn't just float in empty void. This is the first bedrock, first principle. Second, the inner realm, that there is an inner way to arrive at that eternal reality. So this is the inner path of yoga or inner path of the Vedas, which can lead us to get in not only contact but union with that eternal reality. Third, in our outer life, in our dealings with people, in our dealings with man and bird and beast and stone, this Sanatana Dharma unfolds itself differently, and we should be able to relate with this world of phenomenal appearances in the way that the eternal relates with it. And that's where we have the most external aspects of any, you know, Sanatana Dharma, where there is a achar and vyavar, you know, in our dealings with humanity, but they should derive from the same truth on which they should not just be a mechanical reproduction of sorts where, you know, things are just passed on because, you know, they are, the deeper truths are there which we must discover. And the beauty of Sanatana Dharma is that it does not neglect or ignore or cut away any aspect of life, but rather shows us how that is linked to the eternal one. To illustrate this, we can take a very simple tale. There is this tale of very fascinating tale of the Dashavatar, and it's, you know, the tale is very well known to all of us, so quickly we can go through it. And the essence of the tale is that God becomes the fish, God becomes the kurma, the turtle, the great turtle, then God becomes the vara or the wild boar, God becomes Narsingh or half animal, half man, then God becomes Vamana, the dwarf man, then God becomes Parshuram, the wild man, God becomes Rama, the ideal sattvic man, and God transcends this too and becomes Trigunatit, and so on and so forth. What is this happening? God is becoming all this. These things are not just mere appearances. And, you know, the very first avatar, it's very fascinating that when the fish takes, God becomes fish as Matsya avatar, and he is taking the great boat. Now, this is where the story is similar in Noah's Ark and other, you know, there are several stories of deluge. But the significant point that there is a very essential truth which comes in this story, which somehow is missed out. When this great fish is towing the boat in which Raja, Sat, King, Satyavrata and many other creatures are present, and there is a Rakshasa who attacks the boat, and this fish fights with the Rakshasa. So the king asks, what are you doing here? What have you come for? So she makes a very interesting remark, observation. So she makes a very, very interesting observation. She says, Vedanudharte. I have come here to rescue the Vedas. One may wonder, how can the fish rescue the Vedas? And that's where we find that some of the deepest psycho-spiritual significance in the stories and legends of the Vedas and Puranas. How is the fish rescuing the Vedas? If Vedas were merely an otherworldly gospel, then what is the fish doing there, fighting with the Rakshasa? And who is this Rakshasa? How does the fish fight? Now, when we look at this, you know, the series of progression or the series of avatar, one thing strikes to, you know, any mind which is a little, which goes a little deeper into the story, that God becomes a creature in the water. God becomes a creature who is half on water, half on land. God becomes a creature who is conquering the land, and God becomes a creature who is half human, half animal, and God becomes the dwarf man and the wild man and the idealized man. So it's an evolutionary progression. So Sanatana Dharma is not disconnected from reality of the phenomenal world. What is happening in phenomenal world? God is progressively revealing himself at different levels of evolution. even when man was not, Sanatana Dharma was there. Even when bird and beast were not, Sanatana Dharma was there. And what was it doing? It was revealing itself progressively. It was rescuing the Vedas. It was revealing that eternal progressively so that the whole creation does not collapse into inconscient, into nothingness. If, you know, sometimes we very vociferously voice the philosophy of nothingness in the name of Sanatana Dharma. But Sanatana Dharma in fact is a very, very affirmative. God is rescuing the Vedas in the form of fish. He does not want creation to collapse. He wants the creation to progressively reveal the divine who is inherent in nature. And then we can understand many of the external aspects which have come up in Sanatana Dharma. The dance forms, how to link to the eternal. The sciences, how to explore the eternal and wonder at the mystery of the eternal. The polity and administration, how the eternal truth can be applied in terms of our everyday life, in terms of polity and administration. Law, based on that eternal truth. The system of division of human beings, if at all, it's not really a division, but a hierarchical progression of humanity, again based on eternal truths. So how the eternal relates with us. So this is the third aspect of Sanatana Dharma. But we can focus more on, because what concerns us really, I always feel that instead of relegating Sanatana Dharma to a group of people or a group of humanity, which, you know, tends to lose its universal relevance and significance, Sanatana Dharma is something, or the Vedic thought is something which is given to whole of humanity. Before I belong to this religion or that religion, before I belong to this country or that country, I belong to the whole of humanity. And in humanity, there is a double existence. It's irrespective of wherever we are. We may be in this country, this age, that age. But there is a double existence in man. And this is the first thing that Vedas tell us. One, our physical, corporeal existence, which all of us are aware of, or will, partly aware of. And another, which is a deeper psycho-spiritual existence, of which we can become aware of, and in which we can progressively grow. And this is something which anyone can practice, irrespective of his religious beliefs, irrespective of where he is or where he is not. So one aspect is that this existence we are aware of, another, there is a deeper existence which we can become aware of and ascend into that. And those who took this inner journey were called Dvija, the twice born, the sacred birth, the second birth, whatever way we can put it. So this, now again when we look at these truths from this perspective, we will find that in many traditions all over the world, this concept has been there of the second born, but it has not been understood. And Sanatana Dharma says it's not an external ritual by which we become twice born. We become twice born when we undertake this journey of discovering the eternal and its manifold relationship with this world. So this is the first step, the initiation into the inner journey. And since the Vedas knew, the Vedic rishis knew that how these truths can be distorted, as I think many of us already know, they guarded it very closely by a method which is really unique to Sanskrit language. The truth was given at once, had a double meaning, an inner sense and an outer sense. To the non-initiate, who was not willing to live the deeper mystery, he could see only the outer sense. And it was in a way good. It prevented the truth from being corrupted and defiled by all our, you know, the way we turn everything into a very closed religion. How beautifully the seers guarded this truth. Because they knew that these are deeper mysteries and they have to be lived. Shrivinda at one place says, truths of spirit are not to be merely thought. They have to be lived. Because unless they are lived, they lose their power. The eternal Veda is secret in the heart of every thinking and living creature and unfolds itself slowly or progressively as the mind of man turns towards the eternal, as his heart, no longer cabined into finite appearances, seeks in whatever degree of the infinite. This is the first entry point in the Sanatana Dharma, the aspiration for the divine, the aspiration for the eternal. And that is the sacred fire. the first thing is to light the fire. But very interestingly, the Vedas speak of, even before you light the fire, prepare the ground and lay the bricks. And the bricks have to be laid in three layers and the whole place cleaned. What is this act? Is it merely a ritual? Are the rishis talking of some external ground where we must do Bhumi Pujan and lay the bricks and, you know, light the fire? If that is so, then how are they speaking of that fire will bring me cattle and horses? Because we know that material fire doesn't do that. They are obviously talking of a very deep inner truth. And it's not difficult to understand it. Even today, we use the word fire in this sense. He has a fire for this. It means he has a zeal and enthusiasm. It's not something which is, you know, entirely foreign to our understanding. When we speak of an urge to realize something, they say, he has a fire for this. He is lit up with this. So similarly, the fire is the first Godhead. And that is why he is the very first one whom the Rishi invokes. But before that, he prepares the ground, cleans it. What are these three layers of bricks? They are our mind, body and life, which have to be prepared reasonably. If I am leading a thoroughly vagabond life, it's very difficult to light that fire. It can be lit, no doubt it cannot be lit. Not that it cannot be lit, but that fire will be soon covered with all kinds of smoke and dust, or it will raise a whole storm in the atmosphere, because it's a fire that purifies everything, burns everything. So, to prepare the ground and laying the brick, and then the fire has to be lit. The method of lighting the fire is again very interesting. They say, take two wood. There is a special wood which is available, arani. And they say, put one on top of the other and rub it. Now, why this elaborate? They could have simply said, take two woods and rub them and, you know, you can light a fire. But they literally say, take them, put one on top of the other, rub it, and the fire is lit. What is this lower tinder? And what is this higher tinder? The lower tinder is this nature in us. This lower nature, full of all kinds of things. Alone it cannot light the fire. And the higher tinder is that which burns on the apex of the worlds. There is a super nature. There is a divine presence. And when this lower nature, in whatever way, opens to the eternal, it doesn't matter what form, name. In fact, they've released yoga from all trappings of humanity. The moment this lower nature opens to something high, in whatever way it conceives, it may be a guru, it may be a deity, it may be a, you know, favorite religion, it may be just simply a seeking for the divine. By whatever way, this lower nature opens to the higher nature by the mutual rubbing. When there is a contact and a rub, a fire is lit and born. So this is the first God whom the Rishi invokes. Agni Mile Purohitam Hotaram. He is called as the priest of the sacrifice. Unless Agni is born, all other gods cannot come. That's why also he is the oldest as well as the youngest. Because he is the one who carries everything forward. He is the bright one, luminous one, who carries the sacrifice upward. Are we just talking of physical Agni? No doubt these symbols can apply there. But this is an inner path to light the fire of aspiration, the first thing necessary in the Vedic path, that man must aspire for the divine. It's not enough that we simply have every day some kind of a ritualistic tradition, but if the fire is not lit here, it doesn't lead to the further initiation. So first thing necessary is to light up this fire. Having done that, this is the first thought of the Vedas. Having done that, the second thought is the concept of yajna. We must perform yajna, sacrifice. The rishis talk of sacrifice. And very interestingly, there is samidha you put in the yajna, there is ghatam you put in the yajna, there are many things you put in the yajna. What is this yajna? Are the rishis simply, you know, some naturalistic worshippers who, you know, put fire and every day they took joy in just putting things into the fire as some kind of scientific formula to purify the air? If it's that much only, then we don't need to really study the Vedas. There are enough fire, you know, air purifiers available nowadays. You have to simply spray them. You don't have to go through the complicated process of lighting a fire and then putting things. But the rishis were talking of something which will hold, outlast humanity. That's the beauty of the Vedas, that they give a path which is going to transcend and cut across sections of humanity, and they knew it that it will be valid for all times to come. Because as long as man is there, he will seek the divine. Man is the most dissatisfied of all creations, and that is his greatness. In one of the beautiful observations in the life, Divine Shobhinda says that an animal is satisfied with a modicum of necessities. Gods are content with their splendor. Man is the most dissatisfied, and therefore he alone is capable of being seized by a frenzy to arrive at the eternal. Man has that. All the knocks and shocks of life. Vedas speak of the suffering of life not as punishment and sin. I don't know, this concept has come down at some point of time in Sanatana Dharma, which is such an anathema. They were not at all obsessed with sin. They talked about this flame making the crooked straight. Kshina dosha. It makes the hold of the lower nature becomes weak when this flame comes up. But what they said, what is suffering due to? They are not talking of some papa and punyas. They are saying this suffering bakes the clay and makes the patra ready and strong to receive the soma vine. This makes the patra ready to receive the soma vine. When the soma will come, if we have not gone through the purifying flame of suffering, then we don't become strong. When it comes, we spill it over. And that happens with people. And it's very simple to understand it. Suffering chastens a man. It fills him with humility, a deep humility. It makes one truly wide. We begin to understand that there are so many things in life beyond our limited being. It makes us truly wide. Those who have not gone through the, you know, some kind of suffering in life, they are very frivolous. They just take life as it comes, and little ananda comes into the being, it spills over. Look at the, you know, a young man who has received everything as an inheritance. And he drives the car and he thinks the whole road belongs to him. And of course, I'm sure in Houston things are better, but you know, when you go back to India, a young entrepreneur receiving all the wealth from his father believes that not only the road, the city belongs to him. And he can get away with anything. His patra cannot receive the soma vine. Even a little joy of life he receives, he spills it over. But when one goes through the knocks and blows, they are not some punishment from the divine. They are beautiful means of preparing ourselves. This is a profound truth that Sanatana Dharma reveals, and the Vedic Rishis tell it in a very simple way. This is suffering is like a fire that purifies and bakes the clay and makes the body capable of holding the flame and holding the gods and holding the amrit and the soma, the delight of existence. So this is the inner journey. After the fire is lit, sacrifice. What is this sacrifice? Sacrifice of all our actions is samidha. Sacrifice of the lower for the higher. Sacrifice of the lesser for the greater, the vaster. Sacrifice of the false for the true. That's why the Rishi says, asado ma sadgamya, tamso ma jyotirgamya. We have to sacrifice our darkness. We have to sacrifice the ego orientation. This ego-oriented life or notion of life has to be exchanged with a deeper orientation. Divine-centric life. This is what the Vedas tell us, that, you know, if we continue to live that kind of life, which is full of ego for the satisfaction of a petty ego and desire, then we cannot become vrahatam. And in a very beautiful image, which, you know, directly relates to the action of the Vedic gods, there is a story of Sunshape, where he is symbolized as a man tied to the stake. This story is in other myths also. In Greek legends it is there, but in different ways. And when we look at that way, then we truly realize that how Sanatana Dharma is universal, because everywhere you see its traces. You know, the whole story of Prometheus, of bringing down the fire, being chained to the lower existence, and, you know, being threatened by Indra, it's a very fascinating tale. But in India, all these tales have been given their deepest and widest significance. So we have to climb towards Vrat and towards Satyam. That is the journey of man, from the lesser to the higher and vaster existence. And for that, we have to perform sacrifice. This sacrifice literally means, now I am not at the center, but fire is at the center. To sacrifice our life means that in all the activities of my life, I'll keep my aspiration in the center, my aspiration for the eternal. It means that in every activity, the practical application of this would be that in every activity I have to see what takes me closer to the eternal and what takes me away from him. And it's very simple to, you know, and it requires just a bit of sincerity to know this. Of course, just a bit of sincerity is a very rare quality in our human nature. But it's so simple. That's why Vedas say, what really is sin? It is that which deviates from the truth. They use the word anritam, asatyam. It is in relation to truth. What is sin is not an external action. What deviates from the truth? What takes us away from the truth? Now, it's, you know, all of us can look within how this truth is unfolding ourselves. So sacrifice is essentially the pouring, gritam, our mind, our mentality. We pour into this instead of the mind. What is this pouring of the mind? So that it becomes more and more shining and it brings down Indra. Pouring of our illumined thought, our thoughts are fritting and, you know, they are running in 1001 directions, like wild horses. They are running in today, in, you know, they are involved in the share market, tomorrow in something else, third day in something else. But when the thoughts turn toward the eternal, it becomes a sacrifice. One thinks of the eternal, one reads of the eternal, one wants to know about the eternal. When this aspiration burns in the mind, then it becomes a sacrifice of the thought, gritam. It is that shining substance, the shining mind, the shining butter. All these are come from that root, as of course Anuradha would tell us this afternoon. Gra, that which shines. So as we pour, it brings down rains of God's bounty. The rishis pray for rain. What is that rain? Things which come from above. The rains of God bounty. In fact, this expression again is used. Rain of grace. Sometimes it's used as shower of grace. Shower of blessings. But when it comes to Vedas, we give a very, very hardcore naturalistic interpretation. What were the rishis doing? They were basically farmers struck with famine. So they were praying for rain. Every day they were praying for rain, not realizing that excess rain can do as much harm to the crops as, you know, less rain. They were seeking that rain which drops from heavens and fills our being with ananda. It's a real inner experience which we can even today have in our inner journey. That there is a point when this fire is lit, and as it climbs, we can literally take a bath, a literal bath in the inner being can take in that shower and get purified. Because these are the streams that come from above. They purify us. Not only they purify us, they flow into us as streams of knowledge, as the creative word, Saraswati and the rivers, which come into us and they clarify our mind, flow as inspiration and intuition as revelation. That is why the Vedas are regarded as Shrutis, Drishti and Shruti. Again, the word Shruti is not I hear with these ears. These ears I hear things which are very gross. And it has a meaning, but the deeper sense of Shruti is that which is revealed to me as an inspired and intuitive knowledge. It is revealed in the inner chambers of my soul. I hear, I receive. People again use this expression. I have heard the voice of God. What is that voice of God? What is that command within? That is Shruti. What is Drishti? Not just what this phenomenal world sees. In fact, our eyes are a big problem. They conceal much more than they reveal. So, Drishti, the Rishi sees. The Kavi is a seer. He is not just a thinker. He actually sees the truth. That should be the aspiration. If there is a truth, how can I see it? Is there a way to see it? That's how they are Shrutis and they are Smritis. Not just this memory. They are a memory lingering in the very secret soul within us, that we have come from some divine home. There is something divine which is there in us. That is the smriti to which we wake up. The word is very interesting. Sometimes the word smriti is used as enlightenment. He regained smriti. What kind of smriti? Is it just a physical smriti? By simply remembering that, well, such and such, you know, sloka is written there, I will regain enlightenment. I regain enlightenment when I have the true smriti. The smriti that I am that. Aham Brahmasmi. When that smriti comes, because that is the deepest truth of our being, which we don't realize and which we have strayed from. The more we discover that, we begin to awaken and enlighten into the consciousness of that. The point is again and again that Vedas are deep truths which have to be lived. And this is the journey. Now, as the sacrifice proceeds, there is a third truth which Vedas bring out, is the birth of the gods. Gods are born in us. And gods grow by us. They seek us as much as we seek them. What is this interesting parallel? Why do the gods seek us? What business have they got to seek us? What is it that we can offer to them? And what is it that they give to us? We have offered through the Agni, the sacrifice of Ghritam, the sacrifice of our actions and everything. What do the gods give us? They give us Go and Ashwa. Wow, Go is light. That's how the word comes from. Gupta, Godhan, Gopal. Gopal is not just one who keeps. That's why Krishna's name is Gopal. He is the guardian of the light. Gop and Gopi, the keepers of the light. And of course the word Gupta, that which is hidden. Hidden from the light. That which is concealed. So Go is not just cow. It is cow, of course. But it is also that which is light, the light of plenty, and so also Ashwa, horse. Today we use this expression horsepower, it is acceptable. But when it comes to the Vedic horse, we have to always think of a horse with four legs. So today, you know, if that is the truth, then Vedas will lose relevance today, because everybody is not seeking horses and cows. People will say that, oh gods, give us motor car and maybe, you know, it will become irrelevant for today's times. But if Ashwa is force and power, if Go is light, if Agni is the divine will, which is ever there to lead us, Kritu, the real doer, Tiska. If Agni is the real doer within us, and our life has to be aligned according to Agni, that's why Agni makes the crooked straight, then it will remain relevant not only for today, but for all times to come, as long as humanity is there. So these gods come. Who are these gods? First, there is a very interesting story. Usually a combination of gods comes. First, it is Indra and Maruts. And it's very interesting to observe their action. They work together, much like Varun and Mitra. They are inseparable friends. So Indra and Maruts come. And what does Indra do? He puts his thunderbolt, chases Vritra into the caves. Of course, sometimes with the help of rishis, sometimes all by himself. And who is there hiding in the caves? Now comes the other aspect of the Vedic legend, that just as there are gods, there are also the Rakshasas and Asuras, the Danavas, the Daityas, the Valas, the Panis, the Vritras. They have stolen the cows and gone inside the caves, and Indra's thunderbolt will break the cave and destroy these Rakshasas. Are we talking of some archaic times with Rakshasas with two horns? Or are we talking of Indra and Maruts as powers of consciousness? Indra as thought, as an illumined mind, which has the word, the power of the word, and Maruts as the manifold action of life, prana in us. That's why there are panchvayus, Maruts flow in many directions. They give power to speech and expression. When Marut comes, our speech assumes a different quality altogether. Because the Maruts are active. Indra is active along with them. If there is only Marut and no Indra, then it will be a very good speech, but it will lack illumination, it will lack clarity. But when Indra and Maruts work together, their speech becomes illumined and forceful. And what do they do? They enter into these subconscient caves. What are these caves? Modern psychologists call them subconscient. Indian psychologists call them Patala. And who are these Asuras? Very interesting. The gods are unified in the light. The Asuras divide. Of course, in the original Vedic conception, Sur and Asur was a very different terminology. Asurs were those who represented the force side of the Supreme, and the Devas were those who represented the light side of the Supreme. But the way word has, over a period of time, undergone change. So we have the various perverters of light. Who is Vritra? Who tears away the booty of light? So many times we have this experience. It is really a Vedic experience that we have sat for a meditation and we feel very beautiful, or we have heard something nice, or we have read something beautiful, some slokas or some psalm from somewhere, or we have gone to a temple and felt very nice. But when we have stepped out, and after some time, where does it all vanish? This is the light that hides into the subconscious. There are dasyus who take a backdoor entry, steal it, put it into the subconscious. And then we, you know, it is lost to us. Then we have to go again for another reading, another meditation, before we can recover it a little. And what does Vala does and Panis do? They cover the light. With what? With doubts, depression, discouragement. These are the various dasyus whom we have to fight. But we don't fight alone. The gods fight for us. We cannot fight with our human will. Nobody can resolve his doubts simply by constantly analyzing. The human mind does not have the capacity, and that's why it's very interesting that one could write pages after pages, you know, on doubts. People have doubts whether God exists or not, whether this is possible or not. But you cannot just heal, you cannot just convince. As long as man remains at the level of the rational mind, only those who are convinced from within, they remain convinced. The other ones will find always arguments, because at that level you cannot fight the Vritras. The Vritras has to be fought by Indra. First we must do the sacrifice, grow in consciousness, our mind must develop illumination. Everybody says we must have Viveka and love, and how are we to have? Everybody knows we must have love. We must treat human beings with equality. Everybody knows, it's not something to be taught. The issue is how we can arrive at that. And there comes the method, by sacrificing our life to the eternal. And when we do it, Indra comes with this thunderbolt of light. In fact, the thunderbolt is made of diamond. It's very interesting. Every aspect of the tail, smallest touch is interesting. And with this thunderbolt, sometimes with the help of a rishi, by the power of the bird, he breaks the caves, releases the cows, destroys the darkness. Vritra is, slays the Vritra. What a beautiful story of inner life it is. Fascinating drama of inner life, which unfolds in everybody's life who undertakes the inner Vedic journey. And then, after the Indra and Maruts have prepared the consciousness, then, as in the story of Sun Shape, with three knots tying him, the knots of mind, the knots of life, and the knot of body, we have Varuna descending. Indra has prepared the ground. Mind has become illumined. Now Varuna, the vast, descends into consciousness. He is the seer. We have parallel in the Greek pantheon, Apollo, which is considered sometimes similar as the Surya, and also sometimes as the Varuna, because he has the divine vision. Then we begin to have developed drishti, which sees beyond time. Shobindu says very beautifully, all space becomes a single body, time a single book. Then we can see beyond time, because Varuna gives that vision. He is vast. Our life is cabined. When Indra comes, destroys the Vritras, now Varuna comes. But Varuna comes with Mitra. Mitra gives a further illumination. He is the Godhead of love and harmony, who arranges things harmoniously. So it's not enough to have vastness, because that vastness can be very confusing. How to harmonize the different movements of consciousness? When we become vast, many things enter into us, and we become aware of many things. So there must be a power of consciousness which can harmonize these, and that is Mitra. Even till today, the word Mitra is preserved for the friend. And he is the Mitra, the Godhead, who comes along with Varuna and further gives, takes us one more step forward. And as Mitra and Varun prepare us, there is Brahmanaspati, and there is Vishnu, there is Rudra. And what beautiful godheads they are. Brahmanaspati, who by the power of the word creates new things. Now is the time. The sacrifice has gone much further. Ground has been purified. Agni is flaming. Indra has come, cleared the darkness. Doubts have been dispelled. Vidyante hridaganti chidyanti sarvasanshaya. No more doubts, no more darkness. Varuna has come. Vastness has entered into consciousness. Mitra is arranging things. Now is the time. Rudra will remove every trace of falsehood. That's why Rudra's consort is Kali and also Parvati. Kali is again the great destroyer, Namundamalini. She takes away the ego and puts it on her as a garland. We cannot be before her with the ego. This is a very nice poem by a great sage, Kabir. He says, if you want to sit in the house of the Lord, you have to do one thing. He cut short the entire process of sacrifice into one sentence. He says, ye to ghar hai prem ka, khala ka ghar nahi, sheesh kataye, bhui dhare, tab baithe ghar mahi. Translated into English, it means, this is the house of the eternal beloved. Not, you see, how they had seen God not just as impersonality, but as a supreme personality and beyond all things. It is the house of the Lord of love and eternal beloved, not my cousin's place. So what is the tax you have to pay before entry? Cut off your head, place it on the floor, then you get admittance into it. What does Kali do? Like Rudra, she destroys our past. All that yet lingers, clings, attaches ourselves, she destroys that. That is why she is with the great god Rudra and Shiva. Later on, you know, Rudra assumed the stature of Shiva. But Shiva's consort is also Parvati, who is born after Sati. Sati is Avidyamai, that goes, and Parvati, who creates a new creation. She is the progenitor, Uma Hemvati, who, you know, after the destruction, the new creation. And for that, we need Brahma, Brahmanaspati, who later became Brahma. Brahmanaspati and his consort Saraswati. For Saraswati is the inspired word, and that word creates the whole life anew for us. It is that power of creation. That's why Brahma has the word, and Saraswati is his consort. And Vishnu as Lakshmi, because Vishnu is the all-pervading. Varuna is vastness, Vishnu is all-pervading. So he is all-pervading, so there has to be something which harmonizes all these different things. It should not become a waste paper basket. When we talk of, you know, oneness, we think oneness is like becoming a waste paper basket. Throw away everything there and they are absolutely in a disorganized state. Oneness is like the oneness of the sky, where all things are there, but they are in the right place, by the right law, rhythm. That is the right law of everything, which holds all things together in their mutual relation and arrangements, but by a law which is consonant by the law of truth. That's why things don't fall out of space. That's why there is gravity. That's why the sun does his work and goes on the rounds. That's why the star-studded space is woven as a garland across the sky. That is why the flowers bloom from the gene enclosed in a seed, because the Sanatan is there and he holds everything in their mutual relationship. That rith begins to appear. And Vishnu, the all-pervading, his consort is Lakshmi, and he sleeps on Seshnag. What a beautiful figure it is. Kshir Sagar is the ocean of milk. Who sleeps on it? Vishnu, the all-pervading vastness. And who is below him? The Anantnag, the ever-unfolding time, which is unfolding itself in a thousandfold ways. It has many, many hoods in many directions. Time unfolds its coils. And who is his consort but Lakshmi, who can harmonize all things with her love, with her grace, with her charm. This is the beautiful image. So many beautiful images of so many gods are there. Again, when the Rishi prays Vigna Haro, whom is he invoking? What Vigna? We often, you know, when we talk of that obstruction should be removed, we immediately think of that my car should run without running out of gas. That's a very, very, you know, we reduce gods to sometimes to really, sometimes one feels pity for them. Because, you know, especially in India, I had this occasion, you know, this Ganpati's festival is going on. And I was going on my scooter and I saw poor Ganpati, you know, because people were drunk and they were, you know, all kinds of things was going on. So I really felt sorry for the Lord. But I said, see, I am lucky, I can just cross you and go away. But you have to, you know, unfortunately be in this august company, these drunkards, because they just don't know whom they are carrying. And they pray to him to, you know, remove obstructions. Obstruction is inside us. In the inner path, we invoke Ganpati to remove all the obstructions at the most material plane. That is why he is the first dwar. So that my inner journey can go on, my yajna can go on unimpeded, because this yajna, the rakshasas, asuras throw wine and meat and God knows what. So Vignesh has to be there. He will, you know, invoking him, we can go on our inner journey smoothly. We can invoke Durga. What a beautiful image. The great protector who guards us against the red wolf and the snake. And who is Durga? What a beautiful combination of beauty and strength. It's amazing. The ever unmarried. And she combines beauty and strength. Beauty is not frailty. Beauty is strength. And strength is beautiful. And she combines them together. And her we invoke in our inner journey. So these gods and goddesses begin to appear. Ila, Mahi, the goddess of illumination, the goddess of intuition, Sarma. They begin to descend into us. And therefore the gods grow. How they grow? They begin to grow in matter. On this basis of this earthly existence, they begin to grow in earth. And then we begin to understand the full significance of the ancient legend. The ancient legend has it in one of the Upanishads. I think it is Taittiriya Upanishad, where the gods descend into forms, brother. Where there is, you know, Aitareya Upanishad, where different forms are created and God asks the gods, which one will you occupy? They reject all the forms. But when human is created, they say, in him we will go. But we wonder, where are those gods? Are they sleeping? No, they are working, even in our unconsciousness. That's why Agni is the god who goes inside. The whole story of creation is fascinating. That the bride of Brahman has gone away, Brahmacharya. And where has she entered? Where can she hide? She hides into the immense darkness created within the body of the Lord. That's a very symbolic tale. Now who will find her? Nobody is able to go and find her. Yama can find her, because Yama can enter into the darkness. Agni says, I will go and call her. So Agni goes into that immense darkness, plunges, which is the domain of Yama. All these stories, I mean, every legend is so beautiful. The story of Martand, the story of Yama itself, Surya is called as Pushan. Even Yama at times, because, you know, he is the one who maintains the law, because as we will see, Surya is the highest. So Agni goes and says, I'll bring out. Now who is this bride of Brahman? Are we talking of some Brahman as some deity or some king who was married to a queen who went away to Kanyakumari from Kashmir, and Agni was a duta who had to go there, fight on the way with some, you know, Dravidian forces and go to Kanyakumari and bring back? If that is the story, then really it's not worth it. That is an everyday soap opera story. Brahmacharya is the consciousness of the Supreme, which has entered and become this darkness. She has become this inconscient world. She has become nature. This is the great sacrifice, which, you know, is spoken of as the Purusha plunging, but it is actually the plunge of the Divine Mother into creation. That's why the cult of Mother and Mother Aditi, the Mother of the Gods, and as she has hidden there, Agni will begin to extract her out. Gradually, gradually. She comes when Agni calls. She is hidden behind nature. Behind nature, there is the consciousness of the Mother Supreme. And this Agni, gradually as the sacrifice proceeds, as the gods are born, slowly she is released into our consciousness. And as she is released, our consciousness grows more and more divine. As it grows more and more divine, what is the sign of that divinity? We have these gods, Bhag, Ananda, Soma, all this entering into us. Who is Bhag? Purified enjoyment. It's truly, it can't even be called refined. It's the most purified form of enjoyment at the gross material level. How does the divine enjoy this world? And who is Soma? There is a delight of existence hidden in life. We have to squeeze it, press it, and release it. And when the gods come, when this delight is released, when they drink Soma, they grow strong in us. Indra grows strong when delight is released. Mitra grows strong when delight is released. Varuna grows strong when delight is released. We become vaster and vaster we enter more and more into satyam, ritam, vrahatam as this delight of existence is released. And how this delight is released? Same process. Sacrifice to the Agni. Consecrate to the Agni. Whenever we have a problem, difficulty, a narrowness, sacrifice to the Agni. Instantly our heart grows wide. And it's a very, very practical thing. We don't have to light an outer fire. Let this flame of aspiration be burning. And when we see there is a loss in our life, take it that, well, I give it to the eternal. What matters for me is the eternal and not this world. Tadeva brahman tvam vidhi nedam yadidam upasate. The beauty is when we do that, instantly, as if a great hand of Varuna descends and makes us vast, as if a delight is released from within us. That is the soma, and not just, you know, the barley drink. Well, it is barley drink also, but surely the rishis were not advocating us to drink wine and be happy. They were telling us to drink wine, but the wine of divine. You know, the one wine which can truly make us fulfilled and happy and delightful. That is the soma. The ashwins, the rishis invoke. The twins, who are married to the daughter of the sun, to the daughter of light. Who are these ashwins? For yoga and sadhana, we need health. We need youthful energy. We need enthusiasm. We need cheerfulness. Ashwins are lovely gods. They give us all this. In other words, the consciousness of health. You see, how does Vedas bring health? This is how. When we do this sacrifice, the forces are released in a system which heal us. There are healing forces of life which stand above and they wait for to come down into our system. Even if we were not to take a herb, by the very fact that we offer ourselves to the God, the gods descend and ashwins come, make us full of youthful energy, vitality and health, so we can perform the sacrifice better. These are the swift-footed ashwins. And then all these gods, where do they lead us finally? Ekam satyam viprava bahudha vadanti. They lead us to the sun, to the supramental truth. And this truth is not disconnected from the world. This truth is active in the world. That is why it lets off 1,000 or 1,000,000 horses into this world. It is active in the world, but the beauty is it is active in a different way. It's a new relation we begin to form. Suryo yatha sarva lokasya chakshu nalipyate chakshushe bahya dosha. The same way our soul, eko vashi sarva bhutantaratma nalipyate lok dukhena bahya. There is this sun. If one asks, what is this earth? What is happening in this earth? Say, all because of the sun. Ultimately, you can trace the rain to the sun, you can trace drought to the sun, you can trace creation to the sun, you can trace destruction to the sun. Everything that happens on this earth is directly or indirectly linked to the sun. Ask the sun, what are you doing? He'll say, I am doing nothing, I am stationed in space. It's just that I am pouring my force and consciousness and light upon earth. Same way we have to form a new relation with the world. That is why the rishi can sit very far in the Himalayas and change this world. Because by constantly growing in the inner sun, that sun pours itself millions of miles across, millions of aeons across. That's what how Sri Aurobindo intervened in the Second World War. He was sitting in his room and working. That is the secret of the Vedas, that the more we become that, the more powerful and effective we become in this world. We don't become like, you know, withdrawn and gone. We become more powerful and effective. We become fuller. We become as if more and more our nature becomes more and more godlike. We have a new life and a new mind, a new heart. That is the birth of a new consciousness. Usha, the bringer of dawn, releases these powers in us and our consciousness becomes new. We have crossed the night and we have a new birth. But only thing is, does the Vedic journey stop there with a new mind and a new life? Or will the Vedas go on to create even a new body? That is the secret that is yet to unfold. The Vedic rishis spoke of illumination in the mind. Om Bhurbhuvah Svah Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhiyo Yonah Prachodayat. illumined, my mind, my mentality may change, because they saw that mind is the link principle. Unless the mind changes, the rest cannot change. But the Vedic journey is still going on, and it will not stop only with the change of mind and attitude and thought. It will go on till the very life force and the very body changes in man, and this earthly life becomes the life divine. This is, I just would like to conclude with some lines from Savitri. This is what I would like to read as a finishing touch. Sri Aurobindo in Savitri reveals this Veda, and the Veda that we have known and the Veda that is yet to come, this man's journey not being complete and something more which is to unfold, that a new kind of being has to come who not only embodies a new consciousness but also a new body. And these are just two pages. I think it's there in the last two pages. So this probably, you know, I'll just read out. These are just some little excerpts. This is a poem of 24,000 lines, and every line is a Veda mantra, but I am just reading a few, just about two pages, about 20 lines, some which relate to the passages which we have, you know, the subject of our discussion. Lines from Savitri. He is the wisdom that comes not by thought. His wordless silence brings the immortal word. He sleeps in the atom and the burning star. He sleeps in man and God and beast and stone. This is the Hiranyagarbha. The eighth son, Marthand, cast out into this darkness, into the womb of night, whom the rishis have to recover with the help of Indra, with the help of Varuna, with the help of all the gods. He is sleeping here. Who is hidden? The Sanatana Dharma is hidden inside. He is the one whom the fish rescues as Matsavtar. He is the one whose journey is going on, and the journey of man is actually the journey of this hidden eternal in us. And we truly understand our journey when we begin to discover Him who sleeps within us. He sleeps in man and God and beast and stone. Because He is there, the inconscient does its work. Upanishad puts it in a little more, management way. It says, for fear of Him the suns burn. For fear of Him the stars are held in space. Because He is there, the inconscient does its work. We say that this is a mechanical universe, that's what the science says. And yet what an order is there in this mechanical universe. If it is simply a chaotic, random, chance event, then we don't expect order, we don't expect evolution, we expect chaos and disorder. But everything in this world works by certain law. Scientists discovered the law, they didn't make the law. It is there. Why? Because He is there, the inconscient does its work. Because He is there, the world forgets to die. Therefore, Yudhishthir's uttar, the answer Yudhishthir gave when he was asked, what is the most amazing, most surprising thing in this world? He says, Kim Asharyam. So Yudhishthir says, every day we see people die, yet we believe we are immortal. And this legend is interpreted in two ways. One is to remind us that we are going to die. But actually the legend is much deeper, because Indian myths are very deep. They are not just superficial. If it is only to remind people to die, it's something you don't need to. The beauty is, Yudhishthir is pointing, it is Ashcharya. And he gives a very subtle hint. He says, there is something in us which knows its immortality. Therefore we forget to die. In spite of death all around us, something within us believes that we are immortal. That's why the Rishi spoke of Amritam. Mrityor ma Amritam Gamya. What is this Amrit and Mrityu? When we live within bonds and boundaries, in the pash of avidya mai maya, then we are prone to mrityu, because whatever is within limits will is bound to be destroyed. One day the limits will be shed off, the limits of ignorance, avidya. And what is amritam in the original sense of the rishi? Satyam, vrahatam, mritam, that which is vast cannot die. Because you cannot destroy it, you cannot destroy the all-pervading oneness, there is no way you can destroy it. So when the rishi spoke of amritam, he was not just speaking of, you know, that henceforth I am going to live forever, that's okay, that's also possible at some future time. But he was first talking of the consciousness of immortality. When we are in vastness, Swami Vivekananda put it so beautifully. He said, when we begin to become one, we have, everybody's joy multiplies and becomes manifold. That is the oneness. When we live in oneness, that's why the rishi says, Tatra ko moha ka shoka ekatvam anupashyata. How shall he be deluded? How shall he have grief who sees oneness everywhere? Because he is there, the world forgets to die. His slumber is an almightiness in things. Vishnu creates worlds in his sleep. Awake, he is the eternal and supreme. This is the journey of man, to wake up to this inner reality and the path of the Vedas which leads us to that by the Agni and the sacrifice in the birth of the gods. And this cannot be understood by mind. So it says this is the wisdom that comes not by thought. The Upanishad puts it, Nayam atma na pravachanen na medha na bahuna shruten yameveshe vranute ten labhyastashes atma vivranute tanuswam. This wisdom does not come by thought or struggle, analysis or by so-called reading of books. It comes when the fire is lit. And it comes when in this fire we offer all of our being with one single pursuit that I want the eternal Tadeva Brahmantam Viddhi Nedam Yadidam Upasate. There is a being beyond the being of mind. Because if the mind can understand it, it has to be something submental and not supramental. Because mind can understand what is below it, not what is beyond it. An immeasurable caste into many forms. Anejadekam manaso javiyo. And ekam bijam bhaudha yat karoshi. An immeasurable caste into many forms. A miracle of the multitudinous one. There is a consciousness mind cannot touch. Its speech cannot utter nor its thought reveal. Yan mansa na manute yena hur mano matang. Mind cannot touch it. The speech cannot reach it. And yet, mind and speech are born from that. There is a consciousness mind cannot touch. Its speech cannot utter, nor its thoughts reveal. It has no home on earth, nor center in man. Yet is the source of all things taught and done. Knowing that all else is known, this is what the rishi said, that it was not a disconnected reality, that jagat, it declared it as absolutely nothing and that alone is real. No, it's connected to everything. It is the secret source of all things, the support of all things. Yasmin vigyate vigyati sarvam. Mind is not all his tireless climb can reach. In other words, the last word of Veda is yet to be written. The Vedic journey is not a book finished and closed, now to be wrapped in silken strings, kept in a sacred place where we must bow down respectfully. Yes, we must bow down respectfully, but the Vedas has to be revealed within us. And as they are revealed, how the rishis wrote these experiences, there are more experiences, fresh revelations which are bound to arise in humanity, because In a hint, in a gist form, in a beach form, everything has been given. The whole journey and its future. But that future has to unfold itself. Because God cannot be satisfied with such a, you know, his creativity will be questioned if man is his highest creation. Because if truly Sachidananda has created this creature called man, who is full of asat, achit, niranand, then truly one has to question God's creativity. Sanatan Dharma is yet unfolding. Mind is not all his tireless climb can reach. There is a fire on the apex of the worlds. There is a house of the eternal's light. There is an infinite truth, an absolute power. So how are we to reach it? We should call this fire down and then ascending out of the limiting breaths of mind. They shall discover the world's huge design and step into the truth, the right, vast, satyam, ritam, brahatam, this right is not a moral right or wrong, but a much deeper right. The right relation that the Supreme has with the world. Supreme engages in great destruction also. On the battlefield of Kurukshetra, when Krishna is asked, "Who art thou?" He doesn't say, "I am the follower of a non-violent doctrine." He says, "Kalosmi bhava." Time the destroyer. So even Arjuna's, you know, the great warrior, he shakes, trembles. And he says, "What have you come here for?" He doesn't say, "I've come here to teach people some meditation." He says, "Loka kshayakrat pravardho." The same Krishna who says, "Lok sangrahart," also says, "Lok kshayakrat pravardho." "I have come to destroy all this." That is the grand vision. And unless we regard this aspect of God also, that God is all things, then we will understand the true sense of Rith. Then we will understand the task of Rudra and Kali as much as the task of Vishnu and Brahma. Because destruction is creation's hasty pace and hell is a shortcut to heaven's gates. This is the secret that is revealed when we look at life from that vastness. That is why when Nachiketa asks Yama, "Tell me about that one whose glory shines through many forms or hides behind the forms." So Yama says, "You want to know about him? Na tatra suryo bhanti, na chandra tarakam. Nothing shines there. You want to ask about him?" And then he gives a description which is heart-rending. He says, "You want to know of him whose food sages and heroes are the meat, and I, death, am a spice in his banquet. You want to see him? Are you ready?" Nachiketa is that fire. In Kathopanishad, Nachiketa carries that inner fire. So it is called Nachiketa Agni because it's the fire of aspiration. So when this aspiration is born in us, then we arrive at the Nachiketa hood, if we may call it. And then we become qualified. Then also we have to do Shreyas and Prayas. Upanishad gives the same thing in a little more understandable way. And Gita gives the same thing in a more comprehensible way. It speaks of yagyarth karma, you know, doing the inner yagyas, yat karoshi, whatever you do, keep on offering to me, patram, pushpam, phulam, phalam toyam. So it brings that great truth into still more practical words. And here we have in the language that we understand today. And then, as we grow into the truth, the right, the vast, what happens? A new consciousness wakes in us. We are freed from the clutches of mortality and this limiting consciousness. The Superman shall wake in mortal man and manifest the hidden demigod. The story of the Aitreya Upanishad, where the gods have gone and slept in us. They begin to wake up. Or grow into the God light and God force. The spirit's force shall occupy nature's force. This world shall be God's visible garden house. The earth shall be a field and camp of God. Man shall forget consent to mortality. Nature shall live to manifest secret God. The spirit shall take up the human play. This earthly life become the life divine. That is the significance of Veda in today's time. Unless man grows out of his mental consciousness, we may read and we may publish books, we may, you know, do all kinds of things, we will only be talkers and talkers. We have to walk the path. And when we walk the path, grow beyond the limited mental consciousness into a vaster spiritual and a supramental consciousness, then it will become not only useful for man, but in a future time, truly fulfill the dream that every religion of mankind has dreamed. The reign of God upon earth. The kingdom of God upon earth. That is the dream of the Vedas. But Vedas not only just dream about it, they show us a path to realize it. Thus, this earthly life shall become the life divine. I think we can stop with this aspiration. Some of the cardinal features of the Vedic mystics, there is a small little handout in which I have just, you know, noted it for those who want. And of course, I have not read from this. Yes, we'll have the question. I have not read from this, but I guess some of the elements are mentioned there. Yes, please.
I have a question. Yes. You just mentioned that God created a perfect world, perfect sun, you know, everything. Why do you create such imperfect people?
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of it. Because his creation has not yet arrived to the perfection. Beauty is that even science is not perfect. You see, our body is known that makes errors. Because yet this world is in the sphere of ignorance. And the way to understand is only that it's an evolutionary world. You know, which at the beginning we were trying to understand that evolution is not inconsistent with Sanatana Dharma. We spoke about this in the very beginning, that how this evolution has led us from the dust to man. But it will not stop here. It will go beyond man. And the Vedas show the path to realize it. That's the beauty of the Vedas. Otherwise they would be simply, you know, books of the past. But they are actually equally books of the future. Now to take this example, we can put it like that. I guess you come from India, right?
Very much.
So you must have seen how the image of God, Durga and all these are prepared. And, you know, the images start being made about 30 days before, you know, the people first gather hay and then they prepare it and then they, you know, put mud over it. Now, if before the image is installed, a few days before, if you go and see, say, what a horror, this is the goddess I am going to worship. Of course, we don't say that because we know she is going to be that. But if somebody saw it halfway through, he would be horrified. This is called God? But wait for a few days. And when the day comes, we go into the pandal and whom we see? That hay and mud transformed into a goddess. We spontaneously feel like adoring her and worshipping her. So man is half revealed God. Therefore, he somewhere feels he is like God. But he is not God. In his potentiality he is God, but in actuality he is a cross between the demigod and the beast. But the point is that this is only God's half work we have seen. We have seen the movie till interval. We have to see the full movie. But the problem of many of the, you know, Vedvadins and many of the so-called interpreters of Sanatana Dharma is that they are telling us that movie till interval is very bad, please quit it. Because it's not a good movie. Anityam Asukham. But we forget the other part. Anityam Asukham Lokam Bhajaswamam. And then Mam Anusmar Yudhasya. This battle is not over. Krishna says Anityam Asukham. But he doesn't say, therefore Arjuna, please Bhaj Govindam. Turn away. He doesn't say that. He says, yes, Bhaj Govindam, but fight this great battle of light, for thus have I ordained you. So this is, first part is the, we have remembered the disconnected sloka. Anityam Asukham is actually in a sense also a grace. Because things are impermanent, they can change for better. Because I am impermanent, therefore there is hope for me that today I am such a horrible man, tomorrow I can become better. Because there is impermanence, man can grow into God. It's a boon, it's not a curse, if we look at it rightly. But only problem is, what is that path to become that? That the Vedas reveal us. Otherwise we have to wait for, you know, because there is a yoga going on inside earth, there is a yajna going, there is a Vishwayagya, Vaishwanara is conducting it with God himself as the deity. But that will take millions of years and we'll go through so many kinds of 9-11 and Iraq war and Indo-Pak war with God knows what all. If we really want to stop it, if we are sincere, it's not enough to really just have talks and seminars. They are fine, they are a starting point. But they should reveal to us the path by which I can arrive at the realization of the Vedas. Then it will make a sense, and then by growing into the consciousness of that, by being spiritualized, even if a handful of humanity can arrive at that realization, then it will save humanity.
My question basically was, for example, God gave the sun, which is perfect, like there for millions of years. Right?
Yeah.
Water, which is great, and they've got moon, which is there for millions of years. He seems to have done all this job, very good at this.
Yes.
Creating the sun, creating the God.
Absolutely.
Is perfect, it has not changed.
Yeah. Even this we can understand on this basis, that matter has been perfected. That work is over.
But why not for people?
Because it's still going on. You see, the first level of work is over. It's like you make a big building. Your foundation and this thing is over. Now that job is done. You are not going to dig again. Now anybody who sees the foundation will say solid foundation. Next stage, the walls are built. So living beings are like that walls. Now that has been also to an extent perfected. Not fully perfected, but to an extent. Has been perfected. But there is a third level. The finer touch has to be given to house. That is yet to be made. So while creation has traveled up till here, Therefore, there is a fair amount of perfection which has entered into it. One cannot say it is absolutely perfect in the sense of a static perfection, because static perfection is a dead perfection. It's also, you see, sun is relating, there are asteroids, there are all kinds of things, and yet, you know, as you rightly said, there is a perfection still. There are extinct species, there are, you know, the damages, calamities, but still there is a kind of perfection too, because life has already evolved in matter to a point. But mind is still not evolved, and the spiritual consciousness, we are still only partly glimpsing it. So man is imperfect because man is still evolving. When he evolves completely, we will have perfection of human life also. Yeah.
Thank you for a very good presentation. You made a statement that life is affirmative, and also the concluding line, life on earth is to be life divine. Yesterday we heard a competing paradigm in the ladies here from Shankaracharya, Brahma Satya and Jagan Mithya, which says, you know, all this is Maya, this is not really true. If there are tragedies going on around the world, you ought not to pay any attention to those. People are getting killed. There's no reality to that. Reality is only above. Reality is only Brahma. Now, does that notion, does that negate what Sri Aurobindo is saying?
Right. Actually, I'm glad that you brought it out, and before I speak anything, let me say that truly they are very great ones, and very frankly, I am no one to really comment on the greatness of each one's realization, but how I have understood it in my own little way, that I can put forward. I suppose the experience of which Shankara speaks of is a stage in the evolution of our consciousness. There is a stage when we have to turn away from everything that is transient and destructive, and turn within in a seeking for the eternal. And it's a very beautiful stage. But if we look at Shankara's complete works, then Shankara also speaks of the mother consciousness, and he speaks of the beauty manifesting in the world. But unfortunately what we have done is we have taken even truncated Shankara and taken a part of him and forgotten the rest. So it's like, you know, people do, perhaps people may do the same for Sri Aurobindo also. I mean, people again with Buddha's message. What have they done? Who is Buddha? He is seeker after light, and for that he tramples over desires and conquers his ego. Buddha was not a monk who retired into a monastery. He was a seeker. And when we look at that aspect of Buddha, we see him as a warrior, which is the true meaning of Arya. Arya comes from the root Ar. He is a farmer, a warrior and a pilgrim. And what does he conquer? Hill after hill. When he conquers one hill. So actually, all these people were great seekers. Now, where they stopped and where they went is beyond, you know, at least, you know, it's best not to get into that. But the question is, issue is not about Shankara and Sri Aurobindo. My problem is, as a human being, if life is only, falsehood which has somehow come into existence, then why this came into existence? Now, the traditional explanation is Maya. Now, the problem with Maya as it is understood, we'll talk about how Maya should be understood in the right sense. If all this phenomenal existence makes no sense, then who imposed this nonsense on Brahman the eternal? That's the first question. And if moksha is the supreme goal, then who bound my soul to enter into this drama of pain and suffering? And after a whole cycle of pain and pleasure and all these things, say that get back to where you came from. Now, it is like God cheating me. You know, it's a modern version of that, you know, throwing souls into some kind of if not hell, then, you know, at least a partial hell, and then, you know, asking them to get back. And who will get back? A handful few who have turned towards the God in various forms. That's the only change version. This human consciousness is played with this game. But if this world is concealed God, if this is Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam, then this world has to one day reveal the divine hidden. So Maya, as in the true sense, Maya comes from, you know, we use the word Matra, we use the word Mata. She is the one who breaks the infinite. She cannot break because nothing can break the infinite. But she makes the infinite appear finite. That is the marvel of Maya. You know, I am infinite, but I see myself as a finite appearance. The worm is infinite, but it is seen as finite. Now this it does because Ekam Bijam Bahudha Yat Karoshi. The one has to become many. Why has to become many? So that the ananda of oneness can turn into ananda of manifold. It's so multiplication of delight, because delight is the root of existence, and the end of it there has to be a manifold multiplication of delight. Sri Aurobindo puts it very beautifully. He says, imagine if in a honeycomb, each honeycomb, that each part could taste each other part, every other part. That is the kind of delight which is going to be at the end of creation. Not end, but at the, you know, when the drama enters from avidyamayi to the vidyamayi maya. Because maya is also two types. One which so-called creates finite appearances. And the second, which always shows you the oneness behind appearances, where science has already stepped into that field of oneness. So basically the word maya was not in the original sense meant as totally negating life. What it meant was, things are not what they appear to be. And this is something very true. Even science tells us, you know, in its own way, that this is solid, yet it is not solid. You know, this is floating in space. So maya essentially is that which makes the infinite appear finite. And the first step in sadhana is to get back to that infinite who hides behind the finite. So in that stage of evolution, I suppose, one could say, if Sri Aurobindo himself experienced, incidentally, in very early, even before he had the experience of Vasudevam Sarvamati, much before he talked of the supramental, even before the experience of Nirvana, he had the experience, two experiences which are very powerful. One, he had the experience of the vacant infinite while walking on the Ridge of Solomon, Takht-e Suleiman in Kashmir. The second, where he actually felt the whole world vanishing and appearing only as a cinema with no life in it. So this experience, now coming to, you know, Shankara and Sri Aurobindo, because we don't know where all Shankara's experience went, but my feeling is he went beyond the Mayavad, but, you know, unfortunately that is the one which is publicized. But Sri Aurobindo definitely had this experience of the world appearing as, you know, dissolving before itself, but also he went beyond it, because this question arises in the human consciousness that if it is only maya, as we understand maya, as if nothing, then what is this drama about? What is this pain and suffering about? See, it's very easy for me to say, when I live in my truth and bliss, to say I am disconnected with your pain. It doesn't matter to me. But I feel if that is the goal, then it's a very selfish goal. Then I cannot imagine global harmony and peace coming by the way of the Vedas. There should be a way of Vedas that it can annul not only my individual suffering, but the collective suffering of humanity. And it cannot be done by mental means. It cannot be done by mere tolerance and preaching, you know, the external form of seva. It can be done if human consciousness evolves to a consciousness which is beyond suffering and pain. Now that is the story of the Upanishad, but this evolution not negating, because, you know, when the Upanishad speaks about the seer, it says very clearly, tatra ko moha ka shoka ekatvam anupashyata. It is not saying that tatra ko moha ka shoka, when you are dissolved into the one. It doesn't say that. Because that is understood. You know, when in nirvana you have dissolved, there is no pain and sorrow. But even while you are living in an embodied consciousness, it is possible to enter into vastness. And in that vastness, sorrow and suffering is annulled. Now that is the path of the Vedas, which is very life affirmative. So then you can lead a life. Yeah. Yeah. Jivan Mukta stage, and yet, yeah, absolutely, the Jivan Mukta stage, absolutely, and then going even a step further, going, you know, beyond the Jivan Mukta, yes, absolutely, rather you act from a new light. That's where the concept of Rith comes, because, you know, Arjuna is being advocated to arrive at Jivan Mukta, but Arjuna has to actively engage in the war. Now that's where the Agni comes. Agni is the divine will, the Kritu, who is working in man. So behind every event, there is a divine will. But we act by an egoistic will. Mm-hmm. Our choices are based on an egoistic stress of choice. And that creates the problem and confusion in the world. If you want to...
He uses two words there. Apekshika satya and paramarthika satya.
Absolutely.
That is relative truth and absolute.
Absolutely.
See, relative truth appears. You are true. I am true. That is vyavaharika satya. Empirical reality. But once it is resolved, you find the absolute truth. So this is bound to resolve, like a face in a mirror, resolving into the face itself after the mirror breaks. So like that, the world resolves itself.
In fact, I would, you know, put it like this, that see, the human consciousness in today's time, see, because we talk about making the Vedas relevant to the youth and modern age, but the problem is, I would put it like this, because this was my quest, you know, I'm really sharing, that I wanted to know what is the link between these two truths. What you say is very true, that there is a truth of appearance and there is a truth of reality. But I want to know how they are connected. Because if that truth of reality is totally disconnected, you know, because it has nothing to do with this except that while you are here, you have to lead somehow, you know, by a certain code of conduct which has been given to us. And that truth is that truth, impersonal, vast, but nothing to do with it. Then there is a schism which is created in the human experience or in the experiencing consciousness. But in Vedas we see that schism is healed. It shows how to reach from here to there and then how to bring that here. The marriage of earth and heaven. So that way, the first step is to go back from the truth of appearances to the truth of the absolute truth.
Also tells you the relationship between the human beings. What do you say about
that? Yes, absolutely.
So
see,
the realization that the every human soul is of the form of Satyajit and Narada.
Yes.
It helps him, you see, to embrace every fellow being as his own.
Yes.
The spirit of service and love.
Absolutely, that Varuna does. You see, that Vrahatam does for us, but the problem, practical problem of humanity is we need also Rith. The Rith is necessary because otherwise, my problem is if a terrorist is standing in front of me, you see, yoga has to be very pragmatic. What should I do? Now, should I embrace him with love? Should I kill him with love? Should I defend myself with love? Now, at every point of time, the Rith and the Agni are there to help us. They will tell us what is the kartavyam karma. In the Gita, the real sense of kartavyam karma is essentially that which is divine ordained. It's not something which I can decide by my mental standards. And yet, as long as I have a mind, I have to decide by mental standards. That is understood. That's where the external.
Shankara himself is an example.
Yeah.
Though he was a Jivan Mukta, he didn't retire from life. He went from every nook and corner to settle the social chaos.
Yeah, and it really, he was very fortunate, I must say that. Karmani jiji visheshatam sama. Absolutely. So that's where the life affirming spirituality is there. Yeah, I think as long as we accept that, it's fair enough because, you see, personally I feel I am a little wary of, you know, discussions, debates, but I feel very frankly that a completest picture, I mean, this is without comparisons or without demeaning anyone, because I do feel everybody's quest is beautiful. And I have really respect for every man, every single soul which has aspiration in it. And Shankara had a very powerful aspiration, there is no doubt about it. But what I feel is that the completest answer to the human problem, if at all we have to say, and in a language which is comprehensible to humanity, in a language which becomes relevant to us, is given by Sri Aurobindo, which is really a completest possible answer to the human quest and also the future. Because ultimately, what is the future? If the future of all the souls is to retire into some kind of a moksha, then the whole creation becomes irrelevant. But he says, no, creation is half finished, and which is in the line of the Vedic rishis. If we really look at Vedas, they spoke of ascending into the Godhead and the Godhead growing in man. The man growing into the gods and the gods growing in man, and a super nature and a super, which is, you know, the gods are representative of the powers of the One Supreme. When these powers grow in our consciousness, embodied consciousness, then I can lead a life, existence, which is no more the ego-bound, desire-ridden existence, but an existence which is divine. I think if that we can understand that there is a divine way of living, rather than just the ego-bound way of living, and the Vedas show us the path to arrive at that, that is good enough.
I would ask this one follow-up question, if you don't mind. And that is, if Sri Aurobindo's approach to life is a complete approach to life, then can we perhaps take a lesson from Shankara, who traveled the length and the breadth of India, established four different months? What can we do to popularize Sri Aurobindo more?
Personally, I feel, Sri Aurobindo has said that what is the way to really do it. I do agree that truth must be, I wouldn't use the word spread, it sounds very evangelical, but truth must be revealed, or it must, you know, man's heart should be ignited by that light. That light should be received by man. But going in the line of the Vedas, I think the first step is for us to live that truth. And this is what Sri Aurobindo has said repeatedly, be an example. You see, I'll tell you, I feel very deeply disturbed sometimes, not disturbed in the human sense, the way, you know, that I'm recoiling or anything. No, jugupsa. But when I see people speak about Gita, they speak about Vedas, they speak about Upanishad, and they do exactly what happens in the Durga Pandal. You know, there is a goddess Durga, next to it there is an orchestra with all kinds of romantic songs being sung, and we have lost all our sense of sincerity. So we talk about Vedas. And the moment we come out, we are full of our ego. Where is the question of, you know, even, I'm sure you are a very sensitive person, deeply inwardly developed, so you would have noticed, it's so crude and vulgar to have an ostentatious display of the ego, to have claps over humanity. Whom are we worshipping? Indras and Maruts and the great gods or ourselves? All self-aggrandizement, all self-glorification is a stamp of the Asura. And the gods cannot come there, and we have to be sincere. So if we are sincere, any of us stands anywhere, he will ignite. See, Paramahansa said something very beautiful. If you have the fire, you will light fire. If you don't have fire, if there is smoke, I may speak about fire. But I have neither seen fire, I have nor felt fire, I have let alone not lit the God Agni. In fact, I have done everything to send God Agni back to his home. Then, you know, that speaking has little, in fact it becomes very repulsive. Because imagine, we go to a conference, I'm not talking of this conference, but I've been to many, many conferences all over the world, and I've seen people speak very nice things, very beautiful things, but in their life, they step out, you know, people are touching their feet, and you know, they are absolutely enjoying it. What is this? And how will our youth appreciate it? Because they must see as living example, that when people talk about nishkam karma, then they don't, you know, take a begging bowl. They, you know, leave it to the divine and, you know, let the divine give what he wants to give. Live with that consciousness. Yes, that is the consciousness of Shankara. That is the consciousness of Vivekananda. That is the kind of action Sri Aurobindo would want us to live. So, I think the first step today is to have people who are willing to live the truth. And if people can do it sincerely, I think the rest will be done. And all external means of propagation are sometimes not only harmful but also dangerous to the truth. They convert it into a religion or a dogma. They repel the genuine seekers. Because, you see, we may have thousands of people joining a movement. But the genuine one will escape. That's the sorry part. He will become a vagabond. He'll say, oh, here also I don't find truth. Here also there is falsehood. He'll be repulsed. So I think that is the first step. Then, next to that, yes, if such, you know, people are there, a group of people who are truly trying to live this light, then yes, I understand that there are many things which can be done at a practical level. But again, when we talk of practical level, I come to the same point, the jirnodhar that the temple needs is this temple. The kind of life. So we can advocate things, lifestyle, which are relevant in the light of the Vedas. We can take out, you know, books where Vedas, let's talk of Vedas, for instance, become not only sacred scriptures of the religious tradition, but how they relate to science, how they relate to health, how they relate to spirituality, and how they are relevant today. You see, when we talk of health also, I mean, it's a big topic I don't want to enter because it's my field, you know, as a doctor, I'm a medical doctor. So it's a field where, you know, how Vedas, it's not only about Ayurveda. If you really see the secret of the Vedas, how it relates to our everyday life of health, when Agni is lit, how it purifies everything, including our physical stuff. So these are the things, truths which we need to bring out. Unfortunately, there is in this world anritam as of now. So there are people, but they don't have resources, yeah? Kalyuga is still better because it means God is working in matter. But, you know, there are people, there are no resources. There are resources, there are no people. Always either men are missing or resources are missing. And those who really try to live these things have a kind of attitude where they don't self-project themselves. So, fortunately or unfortunately, that's God's larger plan. The self-projected ones are, you know, all over the picture and God is hiding behind. And Sri Aurobindo used a very nice expression. God's last resort from a, God's last refuge from the world's profaning touch, you know. That's why the story goes that, you know, wherever God went, he was being spoiled by the touch of people. You know, everybody was wanting to reduce him to this formula, that formula. So he said, where should I hide? So he hid in the heart of man. So we will look everywhere except here. So the first step is to realize him inside, I think. And the path to realize it should be the one which should be made into the forefront. I mean, every yoga kendra or institutes should tell us not just about some rituals and practices and philosophies. They should tell us how we can realize that truth inside. And I think Sri Aurobindo would want that. I don't think Sri Aurobindo would want that, okay, put him and how many people worship him. He doesn't want that. He wants this world to awaken to a new light. And of course his light is available, his truth is available, and I'm sure those who are ready, he will send the call. So our task is to live that truth, the rest he will look into it. And I have the faith that it's bound to happen, because he has said so.
I want to ask you one question. I'm not a great hero of Vedanta, but I want to ask you one question. What do you think is, what is the purpose? What do you think that we are doing today?
Yes, what would be the purpose of light descending into darkness, but to create light? So we have descended into this darkness, so that this can become a home for the wonderful and a garden of divine delight. We have entered into this suffering world so that here we can create immortality and light and bliss. That is worthy of our godliness. It's, you know, we should give some respect to God. He is after all almighty. So he will take upon himself the most difficult problem. And I think the most difficult problem he has taken is to transform man. Because man very readily transforms God into his image. It's very easy for me to have an anthropomorphic image of God as a big judge, because I want guilty to be punished, so God is the one ever busy punishing people or rewarding them, like a big CEO, because that's what I want. If my neighbor has done some harm to me, I want him to be harmed by God's curse. And I enjoy if this is told to me that, you know, God is a big punisher, or, you know, he is going to reward you in some heaven or somewhere on earth. But that's transforming God into human image. What God wants, that we should become divine. And that's where I feel yesterday a point was missed. You know, when there was this talk about history and ahistory, all that is fine. But in India, in the Indian dharma, or, you know, somehow this word carries many, in the Sanatana dharma, there is also God's personal example, which is relevant to humanity. And Krishna says this in so many words in the Gita. He says that I assume this human body so that human beings can take it as a gateway and become. Now this is not, belittling the fact that there are so many paths. When God assumes a human body, it gives to the human being a very concrete and direct experience. And his heart opens to the touch of the eternal. Otherwise only his mind opens to an impersonal self. So it has its place and significance. God assumes an imperfect human body so that one day this earthly life can become life divine. So the point is, we are doing here, we are his anshas, mamevansh. And we are battling against the forces of darkness and light, or rather the forces of darkness and light are battling within us. Therefore we find this life a field of struggle. But through this struggle, a greater truth, the truth of immortality, the truth of divinity, is bound to emerge in the course of distant time. Not yet, it is not yet there. Now it is only as a sacred aspiration in man. And we have to find how we can discover it. And incidentally, one doesn't have to know Vedanta or Upanishad in the sense of reading it. One has to discover it inside. You see, today we talk of Vivekananda's and Sri Aurobindo's views on Vedas. And these are two, one of the powerful, authentic, you know, who can deny that, you know, kind of truth that in modern times, of course, in ancient times, there were Shankara and many others. Now, what was the truth of these people? Vivekananda was an atheist. He had not read Vedas. He had not read Upanishads. His quest was, can you show me God? He discovered Vedanta. Then he spoke of it. What about Sri Aurobindo? Sri Aurobindo, when he was in Chandanagar, he had these vision of goddesses who were coming here to him. He saw Ila, he saw Mehi, he saw Saraswati. He was relating with all these gods and goddesses, and he didn't know who are they. And then when he read the Vedas, he found, oh, these are the experiences I am having. So Vedas is inside us, and we have to, you know, there was talk about rescuing the Veda, about some number of slokas being lost. And it was reminding me of a story. You see how Vedas can come everywhere. In a Hollywood film, the film was Bulletproof Monk. I don't know, some of us may have seen it. Now this monk has to, you know, he was a child and he is outcast from a Tibetan monastery because of Chinese invasion. And this monk has some slokas, sutras written on him, with him, which can actually make man immortal. Now obviously there is a devil in the picture who wants it. Now he has, he has five of them or six of them, and the seventh one he doesn't have. So this monk carries it everywhere in a small little packet, you know, a rolled paper leaf, palm leaf, and he, of all the people, he gets in touch with a thief. And he says, you are the one who was meant to guard this. And very interesting, because, you know, monks feel very bad that how he can say that a thief is my worthy successor. And it is really true in the light of Sanatana Dharma. We have stories of Satyakam Jabali, we have stories of Ratnakar, so many stories, Angulimal, but let's not go into, because these stories are fascinating. Now this monk, tells him to guard, but through a twist of events, this is lost and falls into the hands of this dark being. I mean, he is a human being but wanting to become immortal. So when this is lost, this thief feels very bad because he knew it's a great treasure. And he tells this monk, I'm so sorry, I lost it, I could not, he's trying to explain. This monk smiles, says, it's okay, don't bother. He says, what do you mean don't bother? He says, no, because they cannot use it. He says, why? He says, the missing piece is written here inside. So that is the missing Veda. The lines of Veda that we have to recover are here. And till we do it, we'll just, it's okay, sacred tradition has its place because it has preserved. We should not deny that thanks to that we can talk about the Vedas. We should also thank science. We should not totally say, on one side that, this Jagat is all mithya, and yet it's thanks to science that we stand here and the Swamiji travels all the way from India. Thanks to science, and thanks to science we have these publications, the recordings. So everything has its place. It can be used as a right instrument, it can be used as a wrong instrument. So there is a choice. We cannot say in this world of relativities, I have no choice to make. I have to make a choice. There is a good use of science, there is a bad use of science. But that good and bad is not a moral good and bad, but the unfolding of the law of Rith within me. There is a way I can relate with this and that and many human beings and not make a very blanket statement that all are one, therefore, I can do anything with anyone. Like all love, turning into all lust in many sampradayas, it happens. Because, we don't understand love, we don't understand the great god Mitra. So basically we have to live in that consciousness. That is the essential truth. When we begin to live, then we'll discover the Veda inside. I mean, personally with me also it was very similar. That in the Vedas I literally saw that what was happening inside me. And I understood, I said, oh, this is so beautiful. I never knew this. Of course it was Sri Aurobindo, the secret of the Vedas. I don't think, because earlier I had read the Yajur, Rig and other Vedas, but I felt this is another of those scriptures with tough Sanskrit and tougher explanations. And so with the Gita. But when you begin to live an inner life, then it becomes clear, oh, this is so true and relevant. And then you discover it will be relevant for all humanity. Because it's about the inner journey of man, and appearances may change. Today I am born in a Hindu body, tomorrow I may be born in a Christian body, today I am in India, tomorrow I may be born in America. Will Veda become irrelevant to me? No. It will continue, because it's a journey of inner being. And that is the great relevance of the Veda, that it cuts across all time and space. It's about man and his quest to become divine and make this life, earthly life, divine.